It's time for the Financial Cafe, airing every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. on 88.7 WSIE The Sound. Today's show is underwritten by The Chef Shop, your hometown kitchen accessory store, where a good cup of coffee starts every day right. The views expressed at the Financial Cafe are those of the hosts and do not represent the views of Southern Illinois University Edwardsville, the SIU Board of Trustees, or WSIE Radio. Securities offered through Nickel Investors Corporation at No. 1 Executive Park, Granite City, Illinois, member FINRA and SIPC.
If I had $1 million.
And now, welcome to the Financial Cafe and our hosts, Larry Lexo and John Graney.
Good morning, John Graney.
Good morning, Larry Lexo.
How are you?
I'm living the dream.
It's a new day.
It is a new day. Well, not really. For the listeners, it is.
It's a new day yesterday.
Okay. It's all relative.
That's true.
So we're back. They haven't gotten rid of us yet. They haven't figured it out.
Just keep coming.
So, we are on our last show in January, which is the month for individual planning.
Which is unbelievable. January 2017 already? You're kidding me.
In the books. So.
And so.
What was I going to say? I forgot what I was going to say. But we're going to kind of pull everything together in today's show, what we've talked about. Prior to this is kind of the things you need to gather, what you need to do, budget, have a plan. So you get all this stuff together. You take our advice and you say, I'm going to have a financial plan done. And now the financial plan is put in front of you. And we will now, today we'll talk about what should you expect? What should you be getting out of that financial plan? Because you put some time and effort into getting it generated. You want to make sure that it's meaningful. It's something that you can use, you can work with, you can understand to help you meet your financial goals and objectives.
Well, for those of you who tend to move away from as opposed to towards solutions, I will tell you two things you do not want to do with the financial plan now that you have it done and ready to go. Number one is don't put it on the shelf and forget about it. I can't tell you, forget about it. I can't tell you how many people I talk to who have ever had a financial plan done. They said, oh yeah, we did that, 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. And I said, well, where is it?
Nothing's changed.
Well, we think it's in the den or the library or, the office on the shelf and gathering dust, and they haven't bothered to look at it. And of course, the other one is they did actually implement some of the ideas from the plan and then did the same thing and forgot about it. Those are the two things you do not want to do with your financial plan. So take it away, John.
So before we jump into all that, we have our In the Market segment, which is a brief little discussion on things going on in the market. And what I wanted to talk about today is we have a new administration, and by the time our listeners are listening to this, the new administration will be in place. And Donald Trump has, he said a lot of things, but one of his big talking points is he wants to make the dollar weak. He wants a weaker dollar. And I wanted to touch on what does all that mean? Why does he want a weaker dollar? And it will get into, which will tie into a lot of his other comments and a lot of his other campaign promises. So what is a weak dollar?
That's a good question, John. What is a weak dollar?
A weak dollar is, let me take a step back. All currencies are kind of measured against each other. So if you have a weak dollar, that means your dollar can't buy as many goods, say, in Britain. If the pound is stronger than the dollar, you have to spend more dollars to buy British product. Okay? If you have a If you have a weak dollar, you can't buy as much. So if the pound is strong and the dollar is weak against it, then you can't buy as much products and so forth from Britain.
Well, and I can only relate that to having never gone to Britain, Mexico. If I go to Mexico and I know that I take my U.S. dollars, which they're dearly loved down there, and my dollar will buy the equivalent of $2 worth of their stuff, then the dollar is fairly strong. And obviously, if I take my dollar and it's only worth 60 cents down there, then I know my dollar is weak, and I can't buy as much stuff with the dollars that I have.
Exactly. So okay. If you have a strong dollar, and using Mexico or Britain, if their currencies are weak to the dollar, then your dollar gets to buy more goods and services. What does that relate to in the macro level? Trump has promised to bring jobs back to the United States. He wants more manufacturing jobs. He wants more jobs brought into the United States. You cannot do that when the dollar is strong because your exports cost more in a strong dollar environment. What Donald Trump wants to do is to make the dollar weak. So our exports are more attractive to the global economy, if you will, to other countries. Now, when you hear Trump talk about China manipulating their currencies, we have been importing Chinese product for a long time, and we import a lot of it. Trump contends that China is artificially making their currency weak to the dollar so that we will us as consumers will continue to buy more and more Chinese products. I mean, I bought an American flag. It said made in China. That's what we're dealing with. So what Trump wants to do is he wants to take the dollar, make it weak, so then our products, our goods and so forth will be more attractive, which then gives him the opportunity to create more jobs here in the U.S.
I don't know, John. What's wrong with that?
Well, it depends on, you know, one thing, having a weak dollar in a weak economy is a good thing because it will help stimulate the economy. We have, I don't care what anyone says, they say, you know, GDP, our GDP hasn't been above 3% in I don't know how long. So even though our economy is improving on a relative basis, it is still pretty weak. So having a weak dollar will help stimulate our economy. It also gets, you know, the protectionism is a word that you hear float around a lot. You know, Trump he's not looking at the global economy. He's just focusing on the United States. That is, you know, if you weaken the dollar, that is a protectionist type of move. It all, you know, one's not bad or good versus the other in, you know, simple terms, but you have to look at the situation that you're in. We are in a weak economy, no matter how people want to spin it. We have, if you look at the unemployment number, not the one that the news reports, but the one where they include those who have given up looking for work or are underemployed, it's still a pretty high number. And if you put all that together, it makes sense to put a weak dollar in place because then you create more jobs here. Our goods and services are cheap. I mean, our products are cheaper, so we're exporting more. The drawback is now your
imports.
Making that transition isn't always easy because we are importing so much from China and other countries, Taiwan and so forth, that their products are going to become more expensive. So in the short term, it will hurt the, you know, average American because a lot of the stuff that we buy is made overseas right now, and those prices will go up.
Do you not think, though, in that event that, let's say that the goal is achieved in terms of devaluing the dollar relating to other countries around the world and bringing their goods and services in, but it's something that doesn't happen overnight. So it may be a year, maybe 2 years, maybe 3 years before we find that that light bulb made in China that we're paying 50 cents for today now may be a dollar or $2, depending on just whatever it happens to be down the road. So my initial thought is it's not a bad thing. We create more jobs. We create more income, more gross domestic product in the U.S. And you can call it protectionist. You can call it what you want. But fact of the matter is the United States average employee is more than likely going to be better off in that environment, having jobs and having money to spend. And they may be more selective and by less of other products, getting into that needs versus wants, our wants may have to go down. You know, it may be more expensive to travel abroad, maybe more expensive to buy the products and services that we otherwise would coming from overseas. But again, my humble opinion, for what it's worth, is that that's not necessarily a bad thing. There has to be a balance in the trade. And I think that hopefully is the direction that we're heading.
Yeah, there are a lot of factors that come into play. It's not as simple as a one or two variable equation. In order for this approach to work, that salaries have to go up. This move to bringing more jobs here, better paying jobs and so forth, that has to happen. If you weaken the dollar, but the average American is still stagnant with their salary or their wage, this whole thing falls apart and could fall apart quickly and could turn the stock. I mean, there's just so many things that could translate. So, I mean, it's definitely, as you mentioned, kind of a baby step process. But what we wanted to share with you is you're going to hear these terms being thrown around. They've already been thrown around in the media: weak dollar, strong dollar, Trump talking about China manipulating currencies. This is what they're talking about and how that process works. So it's a macro level, very 30,000 view discussion that we just had, but it does trickle down to, you know, our pocketbook, you know, our wallets. Will we have the money to withstand imported goods costing a little bit more?
Well, isn't it a big extent, isn't it about choices?
So easy for you to say.
Now we make choices based on how many of what we may want to buy, and it may be that we can't afford to buy everything we want to buy at that point. So
Getting
back to the basics of budgeting, getting back to the basics of having a financial plan that actually works and it actually takes into account the situation of the gross domestic product, the amount of money that other things from other countries cost, and so forth. So a weaker dollar is not necessarily a bad thing in the context that it sounds like right off the news media, so to speak.
Yeah, and you know, here's the article I was looking at. A strong dollar means that our currency buys more of foreign country goods, and that's where we've been. This could be good for consumers and international travelers because the things they want to buy, think of electronics, are going to be cheaper. A weak dollar means our currency buys less of foreign countries' goods or services. Prices on imported goods rise. We import a lot, and you know, to make that transition will take time. Consumers will pay more for imported goods, foreign travel, and they may need to scale back vacation or whatever because it's more expensive if they do want to travel abroad. So that, in a nutshell, kind of sums up the in the market segment and the weak dollar, strong dollar. If you have questions on that, go to our website, www.thefinancialcafe.us. And our email addresses are under the Contact Us tab, and we'd be glad to answer those questions for you.
Take a moment. Give us a contact. You know, send us an email. Tell us what you do like about the show and potentially what you don't like, although I can't imagine what
that
would be.
If you're complaining, the email is llexo at
nickelfinancial.com.
Just kidding. You can send me your complaints. I'm good with the complaint department.
He's got broad shoulders. Jay Graney at nickelfinancial.com. Let us know what you think. And any ideas for future shows or additional discussion into the areas of financial planning, the things we deal with on a day-to-day basis, and we'd be happy to bring them to upcoming shows.
Speaking of financial planning,
yes, we are
now going to talk about what the financial plan should look like. So I pulled up several articles, tied that into what we do with our clients. And I have a top 10 list that has 12 items on it. This must be one of Larry's lists.
Yeah, so, top 10, 12, yeah.
So, yep, we're good at math, folks. The first item on our list is measurable written goals. And Larry, you are big on written goals, so I will let you take bullet point number one.
After my own heart, a plan is only a plan if it has written has been written down in some form or fashion by you or in conjunction with your planner, that it has specific time frames, it has specific measurable objectives, goals that you want to reach at a particular time, that you implement the plan, and that you do indeed monitor it on an ongoing basis, that you have those measurable and attainable goals, because an individual starting out at age 21 saying, I want to have $1 million by age 30 is great, but how attainable is it depending on what they're going into and how they're planning for the future? They have to be relevant to the current situation. You know, if you want to work on world peace, that may take a little different career path than working on your motorcycle or whatever it happens to be, but so it has to be relevant. And you do have to have a time frame. And remember your time frame. Time is the one thing that you have a limited amount of. It may seem like it's unlimited at a young age, but if you're looking at a fixed amount of, let's say you lived at age 100, by the time you're 50, you're halfway there. So, you know, keep in mind time frame and give yourself some realistic goals and objectives to meet in the meantime.
So you're saying that they should be smart.
They should be smart.
And SMART is an acronym that stands for your measurable written goals should be smart. They should be specific. They should be measurable, attainable, relevant, and you need to have a time frame.
Isn't that what I said?
Well, I was just providing an acronym to help people okay. remember what you said because, you know, it's so important. I wanted to make sure that they actually understood.
He wants to be smart.
Oh, I would love to be smart. So, specific. When you provided the data to your planner, they should have been specific. You know, we want to accomplish this, this, and this. And when you get your results back, again, they should be specific to that. Measurable. You want to make sure that you have something to measure, whether it's portfolio performance or this goal or that goal, that it's measurable and you have some sort of benchmark that you can compare things to. Attainable. You know, Larry mentioned last week that he wants to buy his own island.
Just a thought.
Just a thought. I'm not sure it's really attainable.
It's a really small island.
Really small island. Okay. Is that on the Mississippi?
No.
Okay. So is it attainable? Are they relevant? Are they really applicable to your life, your lifestyle, and so forth? And then what is a time frame? Do you want to do this over 5 years, 10 years? Are you looking at retirement where if you're 65, you have 20 plus years? So that is what SMART stands for. Now, I hear a lot of commercials on the radio harping on the next bullet point here. A clear distribution plan was one of the top items in the articles that I was reading. And folks, if you had a financial plan done and they focused on the accumulation phase, the only way they could get that number for you, I think my voice is changing, the only way they can get that number for you is if they focus on the distribution side of it. That's where you need to have this much money today in order to meet your goals and objectives. So you're going to hear a lot of marketing and so forth on the radio saying, is your financial planner providing a distribution plan? Well, a financial plan is going to have the distribution side of it, or it should anyway. So if you determine that you want to spend $2,000, $4,000 a month in retirement, you want to make sure that you're able to do that. And that is the distribution side of it. I've had too much coffee. Everything's starting to go fast now.
It seems like it. You're getting ahead of yourself here, John.
Well, it happens. So, bullet point three, what is the required rate of return? Now, this will also tie into, is it attainable? If your planner's coming back saying you need a 12% rate of return to meet your goals and objectives, and they're not providing you with some other alternatives, you need to think about that, because you may get 12% in any given year, but over the your lifetime, the lifetime of your plan, an average return of 12% is unattainable.
A little unrealistic.
Absolutely.
A little unrealistic. I'm going to go back to number two, John.
I figured instead you would. You were looking at me like, we're not done here. I got a tangent to go on.
Instead of jumping ahead, a clear distribution plan, and I think that relates to my prior lifetime, career in engineering, because when you're designing an engineering system regardless of what it is, and I could name many examples of that, which I will refrain from doing for the sake of time, but if you're designing an engineering system, you have to look at the end result first. What is the outcome? What is the result that I'm trying to achieve? And work backwards, because you can't...
So you read the end of the book first and then go back and start again.
Well, I usually read the front cover and the back cover and, you know, find out what it's about.
How it ends.
Yeah, how it ends. And then I go back to the beginning. But that way it gives me a clear understanding of how we get to the end, you know, as you go.
Just in case you die, at least you know how the book ends.
I do, yeah. Okay. That way you've got that part taken care of. But it takes a clear understanding of what the result is. If you don't know where you're going, as they say, how the heck are you going to get there? So whether you're planning a vacation or planning your retirement, you have to have the goal in mind and work backwards to come to how much do you have to put away to reach the goal, what time frame do you have, and what is the rate of return that it's going to take that may be realistic to attain that result.
That's it?
That's it.
Wow, that was a quickie. All right. So the required rate of return, I jumped ahead of Larry's discussion there, but that's a key number. You want to make sure that's a reasonable number, and we'll touch on that number here when we get to bullet point 5 and 6. But number 4 relates to what we call probability testing. Now, folks, we don't have the crystal ball. If we had the crystal ball, I might still be doing the radio show.
We'd be rich.
Yeah, we'd be rich, but I'd probably be still doing the show. It's fun. But lost that thought. Brain cramp. Getting old. So probability testing. There's a few different ways to what we call stress test or provide a probability statistic for you with regards to your plan.
So you mean I just can't pick a number, even a reasonable number, 4 or 5% rate of return on average year to year to year to year, apply that to my portfolio and assume that's going to give me an accurate result?
Well, the old financial plans, that would work.
You'd know about that.
You would know better. Let's say 8% would seem to be a big number. You know, that was the average return. Well, the problem with average in this context is that means half the probability is above and half the probability is below. So you would be basing your retirement, by definition, on the probability of a flip of a coin. You have a 50-50 probability of your plan working out because you're using an average. What we like to do is go beyond the 50-50 probability and try and get it to where it's a little bit more reasonable. So we can do what's called historical stress testing. So we know what cash, stocks, and bonds and inflation have been since 1926. If you have 40 years of joint life expectancy, did your plan work from 1926 to 1966? Okay. And then roll forward, whether it's 3 or 5 years, and keep going until you run out of years on the back end. But we may get 15 sample periods that we can look at and say, you know what? Using these 15 sample periods that we looked at, we have a probability of 80% of the time those plans worked. That's a reasonable number to work with, 80%, 85%. You're never going to get 100% because we just don't know what the future holds. But if you have 80 to 85% of the goals met on that type of probability, you can then say, as long as we update this plan each and every year, we can make up that 15% that we're just unsure of to make sure that you stay on track.
So it goes back to the implementation and monitoring phase that we talked about and continue to talk about.
Absolutely. Bad timing. Now, this is taking the historical stress testing analysis
to an extreme.
We're going to say the first 2 years of your retirement, based on how your portfolio is allocated, we're going to give you some really lousy returns. And what we're trying to determine here is, do you have enough cushion, enough assets in your portfolio to be able to handle a 20% loss in year one and a 10% loss in year two? Because what happens in that scenario is you just lost 30% of your portfolio's value, and you've been spending the money because you're now in the distribution phase. So if it comes back saying that, yes, you have 80% probability of meeting your goals and objectives, even though year one and year two of your retirement are terrible as far as stock market performance, your investment performance, that's a great thing. And that's what we want to see. And the last piece, or the last way that we can do probability testing, is called Monte Carlo. And
I like to visit there sometime.
isn't that where your island is?
Yeah, well, it's close.
Okay.
Yeah, close by.
Right. Monte Carlo simulation. And I have to go back and look. I remember reading how it ended up with that name, but it's not gambling. But what the model does is if it's a statistical quantitative analysis, but essentially what it's doing is based on how your portfolio is allocated, you're going to have an expected range of returns that your portfolio could experience. It will then randomly select. So if you have 40 years of life expectancy, it will randomly select 40 returns within that range of returns that your portfolio could experience. And then it will resequence those 40 selected return numbers 10,000 times. And come back and say, based on the 10,000 trials that we ran, hopefully 80% came back or 85% came back with a value greater than zero at your death, meaning that you had plenty of money for your retirement. If it comes back with 20% probability, that means you ended up with more retirement than you did money, and we need to make some changes. So, folks, we don't have the crystal ball. We don't have the end-all, be-all with this. But what we want to do is take all the tools that we have to present our clients or your advisors presenting to you a reasonable plan. You start off with the average return. Then you work your way through these different testing methods. And if your plan does not have historical stress testing, bad timing, and Monte Carlo simulations, you may want to ask for your advisor why they're not there. Or if you can do them, can you please do them? Because that makes everything that has been prepared a little bit more tangible. And Larry is looking something up, so I'm expecting to come my way.
He is expecting correctly. Now that we do have access to the internet from our internal studio where nothing else penetrates.
We are kind of in a fortress, aren't we?
We are in a fortress, yeah, and forget the telephone or anything else. But our engineer gave us access. That's always dangerous. Monte Carlo simulation, interestingly enough, is basically, as it's defined, if you look it up, a computerized mathematical technique that allows people to account for risk in quantitative analysis and decision-making, which pretty much says what John just said.
You didn't trust me?
The technique is used by professionals in widely disparate, let's see, there's a good word there, widely disparate fields such as finance, as we do, project management, energy manufacturing, engineering, research, development, insurance, oil and gas, transportation, and the environment. So it's a widely used mathematical model that allows a decision maker to look at a range of possible outcomes and the probabilities that will occur for any choice in action, and allows us to vary the choices, because when we run Monte Carlo simulation in a retirement plan, we're able to go in and change the assumptions based on if you come out, let's say you only have a 65% chance of succeeding with the simulation that we run. That's not where I want to be with my clients. I want to be at 80-85% or above. Believe it or not, I have some that are in the 90% range, and they're doing very well for themselves and their future.
They need to spend more money.
They could do that easily and still stay within the realm of probability. But the probability is if you're at 60-65%, we can go and make some minor tweaks. Well, what if you, instead of putting away 8% into your retirement plan, you put away 10%? Maybe that bumps it from 65 to 68 or even 70%, a small change given time. If you have more than 10 years to retirement, can make a huge outcome differential in the result that you have from the Monte Carlo simulation. So it is something that allows us to look into the future. It's not a crystal ball, but allows us to look into the future based on historical results, doing some projections, interest rates, amount of money being put away, the result of the markets and so forth. And I'm pretty comfortable if I can get an 80-85% probability of the plan working, provided that they implement and they monitor and continue the plan on track. So Monte Carlo simulations is something that if your advisor is not talking about them, I would begin to wonder why, because that is the state of the art in our industry to run the probability of success. Not just, I think you're going to be okay because we assumed a reasonable rate of return.
Absolutely. So Daryl gave you internet access, but not me.
We understand that. Yes.
Okay. I'll have a little chit-chat there. But so since you have the internet, can you look up how they came up with that name? I know it had something to do with the military doing testing or running these simulations for nuclear weapons, probably somewhere in Aberdeen proving grounds. But anyway, I'm just curious because that's one of those things that's kind of bothering me. I can't remember.
The technique was first used by scientists working on the atom bomb.
Yeah,
imagine that. It was named Monte Carlo for the Monaco resort town, renowned for its casinos. Since its introduction in World War II, Monte Carlo simulation has been used to model a variety of both physical and conceptual systems. So it is named after Monte Carlo, the real city. I don't know why. It doesn't go into that. But it was first used and accepted in the design and manufacture of the atomic bomb. So that's where Monte Carlo simulation came from.
That's probably just a code word for a military program that they didn't want to say atomic bomb.
Exactly. Yeah, Monte Carlo. There's an A in there somewhere.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So we're good on that one?
We're good, I think.
I think we beat that one pretty good. Number five. Now, this will get back to the required rate of return. Is it reasonable? What or how is my pre-retirement portfolio allocated? And bullet point six, how is my post-retirement portfolio allocated? And as we are talking about, the average return is just that. It's an average. It's a 50-50 probability. That also assumes that you have the exact same investment portfolio throughout your whole life. And that is not reasonable. That is not realistic because your accumulation phase when you're in your 20s should be much riskier than when you're ready to retire and you're in your distribution phase where now you want to preserve everything that you have accumulated and you want to start producing income. They are two very different retirement portfolios. So if the output that you're looking at doesn't account for that, that's another question that you should be asking your advisor, because if they are assuming from age 60 to age 85, which is your retirement period, that you're still earning 8-9%, it's not very reasonable, because you're going to have a portfolio that with a smaller amount in equities is going to have a much tougher time generating that type of average return. So that is the importance. Whoops, there we go. Back. Hit the mic there. Sorry about that. The importance of accounting for two different portfolios, because that will account for two different rates of returns that your investments are going to earn during that time period.
And one of the interesting factors we run into working with couples is if one is much more aggressive than the other one, and how that relates to both pre and post portfolio investing and the allocations appropriate to that. So you want to touch base on that, John?
I'm sorry, I was reading something I wasn't listening to.
Yeah. When the individuals we're working with in a couple have differing objectives in terms of risk tolerance.
Oh, that's always fun.
And the husband or wife, in both cases, is much more aggressive in terms of investing the portfolio versus the partner who may not be so subjective to losses or loss of large numbers, certainly, in their portfolio.
Absolutely. What I usually do in that situation is that, is it reasonable, since you both have an equal stake in this, that we take the average of the numbers that you're using and use that as, and most times that works. Because one of the things you have to remember as an investor, as a person who has a plan, there are two aspects to your plan. You got the emotional side and you got the quantitative side. The emotional side is, can I handle the volatility that comes with the quantitative number for my rate of return? So if you have a 9% quantitative rate of return number that you need, that's a sizable stock portfolio. So can you handle the volatility that will come with that on a short-term basis without, I was going to say pulling your hair out, but I knew that would just tee one up a good joke for you.
Yeah, we could go there.
but can you handle that? Or if you have the mentality that I'm going to bury my money in the backyard, first, tell me where you live. And two, if we put you in a portfolio that has a lot of volatility, you're not going to be very happy and everything's going to fall apart. So as advisors, as investors, you need to blend those two sides of this equation.
It makes sense, but I think it is time to talk about our sponsor, the Chef Shop, located in Edwardsville. As we both know, been there many times and keep going back because they have lots of good stuff. They're 2320 Troy Road, Edwardsville, 62025, in the Schnucks Plaza right next to Target. The phone number is 618-659-9840. As we've mentioned before, if you go into the Chef Shop and you tell them at the desk or talking to either Scott or Nancy Schneider, the owners, that you have listened to the show and they are coming in for your free gift, they will give you a free T-shirt. So if you want a Financial Cafe T-shirt, they are pretty cool, then just go in, tell them that you listened to the show, you get a free T-shirt. Actually, I think they're going to let you sample some of the fudge if you want to do that.
Speaking of the fudge.
As well as some of the coffee. Yeah, what about fudge, John?
My oldest, Declan, he has science fair. Last week, I'm trying to remember how we're taping these, but he had a science fair project and we used fudge to determine crystal formation and so forth.
Was it Chef Shop fudge?
Oh my gosh, no. Holy cow. I was like, I'm not even sure this is in the same food group. It met the goals for his science fair, but it was nothing. Not even, I wouldn't even say that. I can't even use the word fudge because it would be an insult to what the Chef Shop is putting out there as far as their fudge.
Because it is really good.
Oh, my gosh. So, love the coffee, love the fudge. I got to start trying some of the popcorn. And Nancy and Scott have been very good to us, and we're very appreciative for them sponsoring us so we can continue to have fun doing the show as long as no one else figures out that we're having fun.
Exactly.
So, bullet point 7. Now, when you have the retirement plan done, there are other parts to your overall financial plan, financial well-being that you need to be able to solve. The first step is getting your retirement plan done. Once that's accomplished, you can then determine how much life insurance do you need. If both of you are working, that's an income that will be lost that you need to account for. If only one person in a relationship is working, you need to account for that loss of income. But also, if the person that's not working is staying home with the children, you need to. There's a value that goes with that above and beyond, you know, taking care of children and how wonderful and important that is. But you're going to have someone be there to drop them off at school, pick them up, or whatever, while you're at work, bringing in the income. There is a number that goes with that, so both people still need a life insurance. Once you have that retirement plan done, it's very easy to start running these other analyses to determine, okay, how much life insurance do I need? What is a tax-efficient way to do my investing, a tax planning module? And then eventually, if your goal is opposite of mine, where my last check is going to bounce, I have the ultimate estate plan, I'm going to spend it. If you're opposite of that and you want to leave money to your children, depending on the size of the nest egg that you're leaving behind, will determine an estate planning strategy. I mean, we talked about everyone should have a will, everyone should have a medical power of attorney, and everyone should have a financial durable power of attorney. But if you have a sizable estate, you're going to need some advanced planning if you really want to pass on the value of your estate to the next generation, because it will get taxed, and it will get taxed heavily. So you want to make sure you have the right planning in place so you are passing on the most amount you can to your children.
John, there are so many things running through my mind right now that I don't know if the next 20 minutes will cover it, but we'll do our best. When you talk about the need for...
Should I just kick back now? We're going on a big tangent. Is that your little precursor?
Yeah, go get some more coffee, take a break, come back in about 15 minutes, and maybe I'll be done by then. But
okay, bring it.
It just really relates to a term that I've used over the years, many years, 20-plus years, and that is called comprehensive financial planning. I think the name implies exactly what it is, that financial planning is not just about your portfolio. And what we're touching on now is the comprehensive part. That's something that I have included in my practice, again, for over 20 years, looking at not only the aspects of how much money are we putting away, how much do we need to put away, what are the emergency needs, what about college funding? What about special needs funding? What about any of the other specific, I want to buy a boat, needs versus wants? So the financial aspect is simply one. And now everyone is jumping on the bandwagon using a slightly different approach that the media, for what it's worth, and I say that lightly, has picked up on, called holistic planning. I suppose it's an interesting way of saying the same thing to me.
We're at semantics. They're just using cooler buzzwords or whatever to hopefully draw your attention. You know, they're piggybacking off a holistic medication approach.
So are you saying I'm not cool, John?
No, you're cool.
Okay, I'm cool.
You're so cool that you don't need holistic.
Okay.
Comprehensive works
just
fine.
I do comprehensive planning, and if you went back and looked at any of the plans that I did 25 years ago, they did take into account not only the asset accumulation and decumulation of the individual's account values, but it addressed the life insurance needs that they had, because those needs change over time. When you are young, initially coming out of school, and you have no debt and you have no obligations, there's a case to be made that you may not need a lot of life insurance unless you have some health concerns. I'll throw that back in there because that is part of our comprehensive planning approach. If you have a propensity for a particular disease that you're concerned about, getting life insurance early with the guarantee of adding additional coverage regardless of your insurability might not be a bad idea. But as you age, all of a sudden you get married, you have a house, now you have a mortgage, you may have a car or two, you have credit card debt, hopefully not much, but there is some, and depending on all of the aspects John mentioned, if one's working, if both are working, how do you account for the loss of that income if it is no longer available in the event of a catastrophic event? And life insurance, again, I'm dealing with a number of clients that we began life insurance policies 20 plus years ago. They are now reaching a point that we have to make a decision. Do they want to continue them? Do they need to continue them? And in most cases, the answer is no, because they have enough money for burial expenses. They have enough money so that the survivor, whichever one it might be, can continue to survive and live the lifestyle they've become accustomed to throughout the rest of their retirement. So there is no need to continue the life insurance. In some cases where you have special needs, that's a different question. Because of the special needs case, you do need a lump sum at some point that either or both of the caregivers are no longer in the picture. There has to be money set aside in a trust for the special needs individual. I will also talk about disability planning. Again, disability does happen. I've had over my years a number of physicians, and it's interesting, physicians and attorneys really are the number one and number two classification of individuals that do recognize and do act on the need for disability insurance. I rarely do I see a physician come out of medical school that one of the first things they look for is disability insurance to cover their ability to practice medicine, because if they are in a situation they can no longer practice medicine, then who is going to pay the bills? And who's going to pay off all of the college bills, education expenses that they may be hundreds of thousands of dollars when they walk out of school that has to be taken care of? So disability insurance is key. We could spend a whole program just talking about the different features and capabilities. Something called own occupation. I've had that with a number of anesthesiologists that I've insured over the years. My brother insured, even going back further into the 50s and 60s. We had one anesthesiologist who was a very successful practitioner. He, in his 50s, had a stroke. Well, legally, he is no longer in a situation he can be an anesthesiologist. He can be a physician, but he can't work in his own occupation. So the disability insurance kicked in and was continuing to pay him close to $80,000 a year to help offset his loss of income, his ability to continue to serve in his own occupation. If you don't have own oc or own occupation coverage, then that may go back to the definition, can you work in any occupation? So again, that's a discussion in and of itself, but it does happen. There's last statistics I saw, probably 25% chance of any individual becoming disabled for a period exceeding 6 months throughout their lifetime. So you have a 1 in 4 chance of needing some disability coverage. And not to belabor the long-term need but long-term care insurance is, again, a major buzzword that's out there today. How does an individual who's 65 years old, the last statistic was that that couple who today is 65 years old is going to spend an upwards of $250,000 in long-term care needs over their lifetime of the next 30, 40 years. And they have a 50-50 chance that one or the other is going to spend more than 2 years in care, whether it's from a fractured hip, pneumonia, accident, illness, whatever it happens to be. That needs to be factored into a comprehensive financial plan. A lot of the individuals out there today who only dealt with portfolios up to this point are now looking at the fiduciary rule. We're back there, John.
No, don't go there. And this is such a fun discussion.
The fiduciary rule now requires planners who allege to be fiduciaries and act in the best interest of their client to do what I'll call comprehensive planning, what they'll call holistic planning, and look at not only the investment assets, look at the life insurance, look at the disability insurance, look at the long-term care insurance needs, special needs. Talk about the wills and trusts. I met with a client 2 days ago who had, the husband had a will and had powers of attorney for health care and for durable goods, which they had forgotten what they really meant, so I re-explained those. Since then, all of the documents he brought in and showed me listed his now spouse as his fiance, which had never been updated after their marriage. There are children now involved, which were not at the time. And, of course, the question was, should we update our will and powers of attorney and health care directives?
Nah, you're good.
And the answer emphatically was, why haven't you done this by now? So they're not static instruments. I mean, there's something that you really do need to have, but you just don't throw them on a shelf and forget about them. They need to be updated periodically. And your financial plan should take into account, in case of long-term care insurance, we talked about the Monte Carlo simulations. And it's nice on our financial planning software that we can build in a catastrophic event. And let's say in the plan that the husband or wife, you'd pick at age whatever you want, 75 or 80 years old, goes into a facility for long-term care for whatever need for a period of 3 years at a cost of what is upwards of $50,000, $60,000 a year today. How does that impact the plan? And by the push of a button and the magic of Monte Carlo simulation, we can tell you that that 85% plan now goes down 80% or 75% or whatever, depending in the event of that catastrophic event. And do you want to roll a dice or do you want to take steps to take care of that and to plan for that? And in many cases, if it's a plan, if you need it, great. The plan's in place and you have it. If you don't need it, there really is nothing lost. And, you know, you can go ahead and enjoy long and enjoyable, healthy, hopefully, retirement.
Do we have any time left?
I think there's a little time left, about 12 minutes.
Okay.
I did good.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get through these and get to the final segment. Blah, blah, blah. Should be able to run the plan. Oh, I did have when you were talking about life insurance, I did have a funny little story. And this is getting something that we touched on, but we need to take account and should be taken into account when you have a financial plan done, a retirement plan. If you have a significant other, both people should be involved. Early in my career, sitting with a couple and made the assumption that, you know, if one person dies, then the living expense gets cut in half. The spouse quickly told me, if he dies, I'm spending double. That's a very different scenario. So you want to make sure that both participants are there and they're equally contributing to the plan. With that said,
was there any explanation as to why she was spending double?
I guess he was very frugal and she wanted to spend more.
Got it. Okay. Got it.
Okay. She was going to have fun.
Does that imply she wasn't having fun?
I was not a counselor or a divorce attorney.
Don't want to go there.
That was not my role. No. But when you're working with your advisor, the plan should be interactive. You should be able to say, okay, when you're at your meeting, can I change my living expense to this? What happens if – what are the results? Can I change my savings? So there should be a lot of flexibility, and you should be very easily – should be able quickly to make some quick changes, see what the results are. And then at the end of the meeting, the plan can be printed out and we are on our way to getting things implemented. The advisor should be giving you a step-by-step process as far as, okay, the plan has been established. These are the things that we need to do. I'm going to stay on top of you to make sure that they get done. You always have to have that working budget form with you. And we will post on our website, which is www.thefinancialcafe.us, under this podcast, we will have a sample budget form and a retirement questionnaire, retirement or lifestyle workbook that you can download and be able to start filling out some of this information for yourself to get your plan moving forward. We also want to make sure the advisor comes up with the next steps, but as well, let's meet back in 3 months or let's meet back in 6 months. Let's make sure we are on track to get this implemented, whatever that time period is that you and your advisor have determined that you want to get all this stuff accomplished, but you should be meeting at least annually, if not more. But annually is a minimum.
I would say annually is a minimum. It doesn't necessarily mean it has to be in January or December of every year. I find that in many cases it is much more conducive depending on the client's schedule. If they are teachers, it may be more acceptable to meet in the summer when they're off, if they are off during the summer. If they have seasonal jobs, to meet during the off period or whenever they have typically scheduled vacation time to spend a little time that they can take and think about where they are currently, where they were, where they're going, and are we still on track to get there. So the plan is the plan. You got to have one. You got to work it. You got to monitor it. You got to implement it. And the end result, I think, will be favorable for most anyone who does that.
Exactly. When you said the plan is a plan, if you remember that Dennis Hopper commercial, you got to have a plan. And the only Dennis Hopper voice that I obviously cannot do. So that gives us a wrap for the month of January. Hard to believe. We covered many topics for individual planning. If you missed an episode, you can go out to our website, www.thefinancialcafe.us, pull up that, as well as pull up any of the forms that we have talked about that would be put out there with the podcast, which now leads us into
crazy story time.
Strange news stories. Now, if you remember last week, I talked about the drinking a beer in the shower and then being able to use that beer for shampoo or conditioner.
Not sure about that one, but okay.
I have done it. I freely admit that I have had a beer in the shower with me. Okay. I now have another beer story.
Why am I not surprised?
Okay. So, a bar owner went into his bar to open it up. And at first sight, it looked like the club had been broken into and ransacked. Beer was overflowing from the trays onto the floor, which were also strewn with money, straws, glasses, bottles were knocked off their shelves. At first thought, I thought we had been burglarized. I realized everything was still locked up. And that's when we saw the squirrel.
The squirrel?
The squirrel popped out from behind a bag of chips, which I think even adds more to the story. You got your junk food with some beer.
Uh-huh.
And what ended up happening was the squirrel, as I guess was panicking because it was locked in, couldn't get out, turned on the taps in its frantic display and decided, I'm here, drink. I might as well have some beer.
Mm-hmm.
And then the squirrel got drunk and started doing some stupid things. I mean, if humans can do it, a squirrel can certainly do it. So he said that he lost about roughly $650 worth of stock between beer that got spilt and bags of chips that had gotten open and so forth. He said the squirrel came out from behind a bag of chips. He said he must have flung himself on the handle, drank some, as he was staggering around all over the place and moving a bit slowly. I've never seen a drunk squirrel before. He was, this is a British story, sozzled, I guess schlossed.
Schlossed.
Okay. It looked a bit worse for wear, shall we say. It took Sam and two customers an hour to capture the drunk squirrel in a waste paper bin, and it was released into the field outside from a club window.
What a headache.
It took a couple hours for him to clean up the mess, and he said the squirrel did not look very good as it laid in the tree branch.
staggered away.
So a drunk squirrel ransacks a bar to where the owner thought he was burglarized.
Well, John, I tell you, if I ever, come to work and things are a mess.
Don't blame me. It was a squirrel.
It must have been the squirrel, certainly, who helped to make it that way. That's not a bad story, but I think I might have you on this one, John.
No way.
When it relates to financial planning, this is a practical story.
This is not a practical segment. This is the fun, lighthearted.
Well, I don't know how lighthearted it is, but it is kind of funny.
Okay.
When you, we're going to be talking about Charlotte, South Carolina. So Charlotte is the site of this story. What do you think you would pay for a parking space in downtown Charlotte?
Over what time period? How long am I parking my car?
A year.
Oh, gosh. Now I got to do some math. All I can relate to is when I was an intern in Philadelphia, and this is going back many years. The parking there was $115 a month. Or I could have taken the train, which made things even more inconvenient. But I opted for the parking space. So if you take $115 a month per year, just round it to $1,000 to keep math simple. Mm-hmm. And if you kept that job for 40 years, I'm at $40,000.
Yeah, 40 grand plus, maybe inflation and whatnot. That's true, and that's for a lifetime of mm-hmm. parking.
So I wouldn't do that.
If you are smart, and I know we know what
we
smart means.
Listeners.
It's specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time frame. We have smart listeners. If you were smart in the city of Charlotte, South Carolina, you would have purchased some parking spaces along Main Street, let's say 20, 30 years ago.
What are they selling this for?
Because right now, you can buy, and according to the internet, of course the internet's always right, but the story on the internet, you can actually buy your own parking space, so you can always have a place to park in downtown Charlotte when you go to your favorite club, squirrel not included, for some potato chips and beer, or whatever it happens to be, or buy your shampoo. Maybe that's at the saloon too. I don't know. I'm not sure. But they right now have a parking space in downtown that is going for $74,000 to be able to park conveniently in downtown.
Does that
Charlotte.
Come with a guard to make sure that it's always open?
It probably should, because otherwise somebody else would park there. But that's a private parking space, $74,000 in downtown Charlotte. So I guess get your bike out.
I could see New York, San Francisco. Really?
That's what the story says. Like I say, the stories online are always right. So if you're going to Charlotte, take your bike. Plan on walking a lot because
obviously parking is at a premium.
I don't think we're going to be building that into any of my clients' budgets anytime soon.
Yeah.
As it goes.
Yeah, that would not be a smart. Wow.
Not a smart.
I never thought of it as an investment opportunity. Yeah, so how big is this parking space?
One car. Yeah, one vehicle. So I didn't even know. Ask him if it was a smart car or not. But,
Oh, wow.
We'll go there. Thanks again, Steve Jankowski, WSIE 88.7, The Sound on SIU Edwardsville's beautiful campus. Come on out if you haven't been here in a while. Thanks to the Chef Shop. Today we were, I'm if nothing consistent, my snickerdoodle has survived again, original award-winning snickerdoodle. It is the bestseller at the Chef Shop. It's blended of spice, cinnamon, hazelnut, and it is a very smooth, aromatic coffee. I do enjoy it. That's why I keep bringing it back. So go out and see Scott and Nancy. Get a free T-shirt. Mention you've heard of us on the show, www.thefinancialcafe.us. John Graney at jgraney@nickelinvestors.com. Larry Lexo at llexo@nickelinvestors.com. Let us know you heard us on a show. We hope you enjoyed it. And until next time, we will be back again.
You've been listening to The Financial Cafe, airing every Saturday at 9 a.m. on 88.7 WSIE The Sound. Today's show is underwritten by The Chef Shop in Edwardsville, your hometown kitchen accessory store, where a good cup of coffee starts every day right. Listeners are invited to send your questions regarding retirement, investments, or any other financial topic that may pique your interest. Send the questions to John at jgraney@nickelfinancial.com or to Larry at lexo@nickelfinancial.com. John and Larry will discuss those questions each week during their Q&A session. If you prefer, they will respond to you in private.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
I'd be rich.
Thanks for listening to the Financial Cafe on 88.7 WSIE The Sound.